humility. Remember that? How much have you seen of it lately? It can be a bit like Shy Game. Our culture celebrates the winner takes all, and some of our most celebrated public figures are celebrities, billionaires, egomaniacs. The man you're about to meet has taken a very close look at humility, and he argues it's one of the most important virtues, especially for leaders. Dr. John Dixon's a senior research fellow at the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University and author of Humilitas, and he joins me in the studio now. Welcome to Life Matters.
Lovely to be here.
Do you consider yourself especially humble, John?
Well, you stole my opening line. No. I mean, in fact, how on earth do you write a book on humility without giving the impression that you think you're the expert?
Yes.
In which case, you're not. And if you're not, why are you writing a book about it? So there's this paradox.
Yes.
And
you can't win paradox.
No. And you introduce this by saying we're putting humility under the spotlight. And it just made me think of... One theologian that I quite like said that humility is a very shy virtue. It doesn't like being talked about.
Mm.
So in some ways, I've broken that by writing a whole book on it. But it's very clear, I fell into this topic completely by accident, by being invited into a research project investigating the origins of humility. It wasn't because Macquarie Uni thought I was particularly humble.
In fact, didn't a friend of yours say, at least you'll have an objective distance from this topic?
Yes, my best friend. He laughed out loud when I told him I was involved in this. And he said, at least you have the objective distance. Yeah. So, and in some ways, you need friends like that to stay humble, right?
Yes. Well, so how do you explain to someone what you mean by it? Because we don't talk about it much, as you've already said.
The word itself originally meant low. So in all of the relevant languages, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, the word humility meant low. It's actually the word for low. And it originally had a negative connotation, to be put low. So it was equivalent to sort of servile or oppressed. But the word underwent something of a transformation so that we now think of it as deliberately lowering yourself. And so the one Latin root, humilitas, gave us both humiliation down that track and humility. It's the same Latin root, though. And I would define humility, just in simple terms, as holding your power for the good of others. It isn't being a doormat. It isn't being servile. It's a decision, a noble decision, I think, to hold whatever influence you have for others.
It's interesting you say that if you go back to the ancient roots of it, it basically meant low. It wasn't seen as a virtue by the Greeks or the Romans.
Greeks and Romans certainly didn't see humility as a virtue. They had another, well, almost related virtue, modestia, or, you know, modesty, which was the protection against hubris. But there was, in Greek and Roman culture, a strong commitment to public honour. And so the virtue in humility's place in the ancient world was called philotimia, which is to love your honour and to pursue honour. And Greeks and Romans thought nothing of boasting about your merit and even inviting others to boast on your behalf. And everyone knew that they'd been invited to boast on your behalf, but it was perfectly allowable for the simple reason that humility was the great goal of ancient life. Honour was the great goal of ancient life, and shame was the thing to be avoided at all costs, which is why historians describe ancient cultures, ancient Mediterranean cultures, as honour-shame cultures. The pursuit of honour, the hatred of shame.
So in a way, after a kind of period of, I think you identify this in the book, it's about 150 years from the beginning of the 19th century to the middle of the 20th century, humility came into vogue, if you like. But in a way, we've almost not quite gone full circle, because we now have this tremendous focus on success and money and fame, and all of which seem to be not natural bedfellows of humility.
There are a couple of stories to tell here. The transformation in the use of the word humility to mean a virtue happens in the first century. But there, and throughout Europe, there was a strong belief in the virtue of humility for 19 centuries after that. But Stephen Covey, the famous author of The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, did a study on leadership in the modern world, where he saw that for about 100, 150 years, 18th, 19th centuries, there was a strong emphasis on character leadership, that books on leadership emphasized the importance of character, that character is really what leads people. And his observation in that, you know, incredibly famous book was, we've stopped talking about character in leadership, and now we're talking about results and productivity, which he claims, and I think I agree with him, used to be thought of as the byproduct of character-driven leadership rather than the goal in itself. So that's Stephen Covey's observation. I think it's probably true.
If we think about leaders, and you talk about Christ and the Buddha and Gandhi, all people who did not have kind of institutional instruments of authority, all of them had humility. All of them have had a huge and lasting legacy.
The thing I'm trying to point out in this book is that humility makes the great greater. You don't have to have humility to have some kind of influence. You can have humility and not end up having influence, but I am saying that those with influence, when they're humble, they influence even more. And too often, I think, chief executives or sports coaches or whatever rely on the structural authority given to them by the organization without realizing that that's borrowed authority. It isn't your own authority. It's given to you as a gift, as a prize. Really, your true authority is your ability to help people in the organization trust you, trust your call. And people don't trust a leader's call based only on their rank. They trust them on the history of their decision making, on the impression the leader has left, when they make decisions, it's in the interest of others. I really think the most believable person in the world is the one you know has your best interests at heart, which is why the humble leader is the most effective.
On Life Matters today, we are talking about humility, and with me is John Dixon, who's many things actually, but among them is author of Humilitas, which has just been published by Zondervan. You can see why the leaders have shied away from it over the last 50 years, because it's harder to do. I mean, if it's going to be about character, then really your character, by the time you're thinking I'm going to be a leader, it's pretty much shaped. You can't fake humility. We tend to see that very quickly. So they've focused on results. And I'm wondering if maybe the time of humble leaders is past and we don't see it again.
I hope not. There was a very important study by Jim Collins, who's out of Stanford University, who wrote quite a famous book now called Good to Great, in which he argued with pretty strong data that the 11 leading companies in recent US history, and he had quite a strict test for what allowed those 11 in, were led by people he described as having level 5 leadership. And level 5 leadership was a notch above the typical level 4 executive with the big ego and, you know, commands everyone to come with them, the visionary leader that we normally think of. He said the top tier of companies were led by people who had a paradoxical blend of professional will and personal humility. And he did interviews throughout the entire companies. So we're talking companies like Gillette, the steel giant, Nucor, Philip Morris, Kimberly-Clark, ones that had outperformed the market by more than 3 times over a 15-year period, very stringent test. And they were all led by humble people, people who had a professional will, who had ambition for the company, but somehow were able to harness all of their abilities and power and wealth for the good of others before themselves. And he argues that that actually gave them an edge over the second tier company that we think of. And he put Coca-Cola in the second tier company, interestingly, because they haven't outperformed the market by over 3 times.
You devote a section in the book to talking about how well, actually, it's an argument throughout. We are drawn to people who are humble, aren't we? Why is that?
Because we can trust them. When you meet a powerful person and you're worried that you're going to use their power against you or to shame you, make you feel small, then you're nervous around them. You're not attracted to them. But when you meet a truly great individual who seems actually as interested in you as you are in them, it's very compelling. I tell the story about Sir Edmund Hillary in this book, who was, by all accounts, a terrifically humble man. So he conquers Mount Everest in 53 with Tenzin Norgay, let's not forget him, and receives accolade upon accolade, wealth, fame. But he devotes himself back to the people of Nepal for the next decades. And so he used his influence for the good of others. And on one of his charity trips back to Nepal, he was spotted by a bunch of tourist climbers who asked for a photo, of course, and they give him an ice pick so he'd look the part. And then another tourist climber walks by, didn't recognise Hillary, and walks up to Hillary and says, "That's not how you hold an ice pick, let me show you." Incredible. And Sir Edmund Hillary, to everyone's amazement, just thanks the man, lets him adjust the grip and goes on with the photo. And so we were told this story by people who were there. And you hear that, and as soon as I tell you that story, your estimation of Hillary goes up. And your estimation of that other climber, however good he was, goes down. Now, what is that? It's that when you see a great man who isn't in it for himself, we trust them. That's the attractive quality of this humble ethic.
He was a great man. I think he had that kind of sense of Kiwi modesty, which is that you don't... And we have a version of it too, that you don't blow your own trumpet. You're not a big noter. Well, we used to have it. We seem to have a lot more big noters now. If anyone listening now wants to think, do you know, John's really got a point, I'd like to be better at this, what can they do? What can somebody do?
Well, I don't argue in the book that everyone can become humble per se, but I do think we can become more humble than we currently are, which is good news for a dominance personality like the author. And I would say the path to humility is first recognize its beauty, because we're shaped by the things that we love, the things we find beautiful. They shape us. So spot humility and then just practice humility, because new practices can actually develop new thoughts, just as new thoughts can develop new practices.
It's been really interesting, John. I have to say that I found fatherhood immensely humbling. I find that my persuasive skills are not what I thought they were. John Dixon, thanks for coming in.
Great pleasure.
John Dixon is a senior research fellow in the Department of Ancient History at Macquarie University. Humilitas is published by Zondervan. And what about you? Do you consider yourself a humble person? Is there someone you admire because of their humility? Let us know what you think on the website abc.net.au/rn/lifematters, or comment at RN Life Matters on Facebook. The listener line, of course, is 02-833-1430. Up next on Life Matters, a unique campaign using sweets as a weapon of protest.